Judiciary on a Saturday. Certainly happy to see so many charming, smiling faces here. It's a real treat for us to recognize that we are so dedicated that we wanted to be here. So let's call the meeting to order. It's Saturday, April 9th. We have Representative Lynn, Representative Keller, Representative Pruitt. Representative Gruenberg is in finance with dealing with some issues there. We have Representative Holmes, Vice Chair Thompson, myself, Chair Gatto. First thing is housekeeping, cell phones. Anybody's cell phone set to ring? Set it so that it doesn't ring. Three things in front of us today. HDR 4, a constitutional amendment from Representative Wilson on the Transportation Fund. HB 215, judicial review of pipeline project right away by Representative Chenault. And SB 31, counting of write-in votes by Senator Thomas. Let us begin with the Transportation Fund, HJR 4, constitutional amendment. I think this has been heard here before, and I wasn't here, if I remember correctly. So yeah. It was heard by Vice Chair Thompson.
This is the first time?
This is the second time this year.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, why don't you come forward and give us a synopsis, and we'll proceed from there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate you hearing this bill, and I want to thank the committee members for hearing this important resolution a second time. And just a few comments to remind the committee what this joint resolution does. And HJR 4 will put a constitutional amendment before the voters to change the Alaska Constitution to reinstate a dedicated fund for transportation. HJR 4 is one of three bills that altogether will reinstate that dedicated transportation fund. Two of the three bills, House Bill 30, the enabling legislation, and House Bill 31, the appropriation legislation, have been...
Where are those bills now?
Those bills have been assigned to a finance subcommittee, and the finance co-chairs have told me that they intend to
They're not coming here.
No. And this bill goes to finance next, and that it will be assigned to the same subcommittee, they told us.
Good.
So the subcommittee work on all three bills then will be taken care of during the interim. And I believe that we've crafted a constitutional amendment that is broad enough to provide some flexibility for future legislators, but concise enough to ensure that the fund will not be depleted, but it will provide transportation funding far into the future. Now, I know this has been very brief, but I know that the time is valuable and you have other bills. So as we wind down the session, I'll be happy to answer any further questions that the committee might have.
So this goes before the voters after we adjourn next year?
Yes.
So this November of next year?
Correct.
And I don't know, I don't see that as an issue, but they'll certainly have the materials in front of them by then. Okay. And give the committee a second to absorb this, because there are some funds currently going into the general fund, like driver's license fees, and how about the fuel tax?
Actually, the funds that do go into this, and I've got it. Just a second, and I want to make sure I give you the right information. I've got it here somewhere.
I think it's in the bill here on page 1, line 14, where it says, from any state sales tax on fuel used for the propulsion of motor vehicles, aircraft, and watercraft. Is that reasonable to take taxes that came from aircraft and watercraft? Because is the transportation fund then wide enough to cover airports, marine highway, as well as railroad tracks? I don't know how far it goes.
DOT actually covers our airports in Alaska. It covers our harbors and our roads and the ferry system.
But not the rail? Oh, no.
No, it does not. The railroad is kind of an entity unto itself.
see Representative Pruitt has the Constitution in front of him, so very careful of what is said around here. Any thoughts from the committee?
I do want to make one comment that at the Transportation Committee did take out the dedicated, maybe I should have my
Sure.
I know it's some of our airport money is already designated to another area, so I'll let Becky explain that. She's my chief of staff, Becky
Rooney. Put yourself on the record and then continue.
Becky Rooney, staff to Representative Peggy Wilson. We found out that airport lease funds we had originally tried to capture into this fund, but they have to go back to the airport that they were collected from because of federal regulations and those grants that they get for those federal airports. So we removed those from the revenue stream, so they're no longer in here. That was the one CS that we've made to this.
So that's the reason for the CS?
Yes.
This includes studded tire taxes?
Yes, sir, it does.
I see that identification card fee. I'm not sure what that is. A driver's license?
Mr. Chair, it's when you don't have a driver's license and you need an identification card to get on the airlines or for any other matter, but they've really become more useful as they've had the requirement for driver's license in the airlines.
And it does say the legislature may appropriate up to 50% of the state fuel taxes, registration and driver's license fees. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, they may appropriate 50% of the revenue collected the prior year, up to that amount.
There's actually $1 billion that would start the fund, and then with those different collections, mm-hmm. half of that would go into that year's funding. The other half would go into the fund itself to help it grow and to inflation-proof it.
And the plan is to take a POMV
yes.
off the fund each year?
Yes.
What would that
mean? And that fund is up to 6% it's stated in the resolution or in the constitutional amendment. And the reason that we have that in there is so that we have flexibility. In the past, just the last few years, it's been a 6% POMV would have been fine. But lately, with the interest rates down so low and everything, and with us not growing our funds as quickly as we were several years ago, it would be wiser not to use that 6%. So depending on what the status is of our economy overall, we wanted to give the flexibility so we wouldn't have to go back to the people for another vote. So that's in there for that flexibility, so that it would be in statute, so that it could be changed as we needed it to change.
And it mentions studded tire tax. Is there a tax on tires that are not studded? A state tax?
No, I don't know.
So there is no tire fee except for a studded tire.
Right. Yeah. Not at the state level. Anyway.
Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there a reason that we're putting in, and at this point we're going to put in the Constitution, not just in the statute, some of the details of the actual fund, such as the studded tire tax and some of these various taxes? Is there a reason we're going about it that way as opposed to just in statute, leaving it up so that in future years we could appropriate, if needed, in a different manner?
Part of the reason was that we wanted to be able to, in case there was a crisis and we had to do something quickly, that we would be able to do it by changing a statute rather than waiting for a general election to go to the people of the state and have a total vote of the people. So it's kind of a protection mechanism if we had to use it. But we wanted to put it in statute because right now we all know that some of our funds, like not only the constitutional budget reserve, that's protected pretty good because it takes three quarters of a vote. However, what's the other fund? The EBR and there's another one.
SBR.
Yes, SBR. Correct. And we kind of can take things out of them, kind of willy nilly when we want to. And I wanted this to be a little stronger, and put it actually in statute so that that couldn't happen real easy. That if we were going to do it, we would have to go and change a statute.
For the record, we have been joined by Representative Grunberg. It does say on page 2, line 5, each year the legislature may.
Yeah.
Very clear. So we're not bound to backfill the fund at all. Crisis comes, we can use that money for any other purpose.
No.
No?
In the enabling legislation, it tells us exactly how we're going to do it and who's going to make the decisions, but that's in the enabling legislation. Not this legislation is just to put it through to a vote of the people, to have kind of like the structure of what we're going to do.
And would the ballot initiative include all these different sources of income for the fund, or would it just be straightforward that says?
Yeah.
Would you like a transportation fund? Check yes or check no.
Go ahead, Becky.
Mr. Chair, ballot.
Go ahead, give me your first name.
This is Becky. Becky Rooney. The ballot measure will include the language, which is the new Section 18 for the Constitution, and that language does include those specific taxes and revenue streams that we talked about. It also includes there's a collective that allows for here it is on page 2 line 7 other designated fees and funds received by I can't find it. Anyway, there's a clause in there that allows for new and unconsidered revenue streams that may come up in the future, like transit taxes or toll bridges, toll roads, any of those kinds of funds that don't exist today, they can be captured in this fund.
It's line 2 and 3 on page 2.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other transportation related.
And that's interesting. If we had a toll bridge, gosh, the bridge would absolutely depend on the toll to do maintenance on the bridge. And is it possible that some of that very valuable revenue could be detoured away from the bridge?
Mr. Chair, it says they may be designated by the legislature. So if those funds were needed by the toll bridge to do operations and maintenance, say, then the legislature would have the ability to not designate those funds or to designate those funds. It's up to future legislatures to designate it, but it is there in case they would want to.
Questions from the committee? Let's open it up to public testimony. Anyone online? Indication that there's no one online that wants to testify. Anyone in the audience wants to testify? Seeing and hearing none. Close public testimony, brings it back to the committee. Since the committee didn't have any comments, anyone want to make some comments now? Great idea, not a great idea. Representative Thompson.
Seeing no comments, I move that House HJR 4 version 27-LS0197-D from the House Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And that's the CS, yeah.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, Representative Wilson, your bill's out of here.
Thank you.
Let's
much.
Take a brief at ease so we on the record, we have House Bill 215, Judicial Review of Pipeline Project Right-of-Way. Sponsor is Representative Chenault. My understanding is the CS is already adopted, and there are two amendments. Did we, I'm trying to remember, did we vote on the two amendments?
No.
So we have the two amendments in front of us. And for clarity, it's version I like India. CS for House Bill 215, I like India. And a lot of pages. And let's see, find, there we go, amendments.
I have three.
We're looking at.
You have three amendments?
Well, yeah, but one of them's not
going to be. I, too, is going away.
With two, number two is withdrawn, so since it's withdrawn, number three will be number two.
Wait, which? Okay, I have I1, I2, and I3, and which one should I rip
I2
up?
I2 is going away.
Okay, rip up I2.
And call I3 amendment number two, and call I1 amendment number one. Are you going to introduce the amendments, Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chair, which is which now again?
Amendment number one is I-1, I-1.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one.
Hold on.
Okay.
Let
Rep.
This is number one. This one goes away, and it's your number two.
This is one. This has got to go away.
This is number one. That's number two.
Thank you.
There we go. Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move amendment number one.
Objection.
Object for discussion.
So go ahead and give us delete B, insert C things.
And Mr. Chairman, I would defer to the bill sponsor and the sponsor staff to walk us through the two amendments with your permission.
Very clever.
Learn one thing or two in a couple
law
years
school,
here.
You know how to
and
handle
how to duck.
So,
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Tom Wright, staff to Speaker Chenault, what we're doing with Amendment Number 1 is restoring the language under 3835-200 for judicial review after discussions with the Attorney General and after hearing comments in the committee. Since the new section, which will now become subsection 3, deals with only natural gas pipelines, the discussion revolved around whether we should leave that original language in or not for other right-of-way applications, such as oil pipelines and whatnot. And we didn't want to upset the apple cart, so it was decided it was better left to keep that language intact and then add the new subsection 3, which applies only to natural gas pipelines.
So just for clarity, page 6, line 19, delete letter B, insert letter C. And as part of the same amendment, it goes... page 6, line 20, delete all material and insert, is that a new section 6? Mm-hmm. Is amended by adding a new subsection to read. And then on page 6, line 21, so this is dealing with lines 19, 20, and 21. Line 21, delete letter B, insert letter C. Is that the way you have it?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Again, all it's doing is leaving the original language intact under 3835-200B.
Got it.
And then adding a new subsection, which is now C.
Okay. If anyone on the committee wants to make a comment, Representative Holmes?
So just to clarify, so the original language applies to all pipelines, oil and gas, and the new language applies just to gas pipelines. So
the natural gas. Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. I'll give everybody a second here. They feel like making a comment. Anyone else in the committee want to comment? Seeing and hearing none, we'll bring it to, I have one person who wants to testify.
On the amendment?
Oh, I think we ought to do that. Sorry. is there an objection?
Mr. Chair, I remove my objection.
Okay, so we have amendment number one. Is there any other objection? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number one is adopted. I think we should probably proceed to amendment number two at this point.
Mr. Chairman, would you like me to?
And for the record, there was I.2, which is withdrawn, and we are now on I.3, which we will call amendment number 2. And Representative Holmes, did you want to offer amendment number 2?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number 2.
Object for discussion.
Objection for discussion.
Mr. Chairman, again, I'm going to defer.
Smart.
Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, Tom Wright, staff, Speaker Chenault. We've had lengthy discussion with DEC and also with the AG's office. Ruth Hamilton Hesse, who is also here, can answer questions. One of the roadblocks we ran into, and I guess I call this my under protest amendment, but it's necessary. And the bottom line is with this amendment, either we deal with DEC when it comes to air quality or water quality, or we deal with EPA. One of the things I was told yesterday is that whenever there is legislation that may affect primacy of air quality or water quality, that legislation is submitted to EPA. EPA will then review it and decide whether or not we are violating, you know, one of the federal regulations dealing with air and water quality, you know, when a state has primacy. And they can revoke that primacy at some point. And we had a rather lengthy discussion, or, you know, myself and DEC and also Ms. Hamilton Hesse, regarding, you know, we went through a lot of what-if scenarios, and, you know, I mean, there was a reluctance on our part to adopt this because, you know, the thinking was this probably or could gut the intent of the bill. But after listening to the discussion, again, it came down to the bottom line. Who would you rather deal with as a, you know, from the state aspect? Would you rather deal with DEC or would you rather deal with EPA? And quite frankly, it was decided we'd rather take our chances with DEC rather than have to deal with EPA on two issues primarily, storm runoff, water runoff, and also water discharge. And a lot of that would deal with the construction camps more than anything. If it comes to rivers, streams, that type of thing, you're going to deal with the Corps of Engineer anyway. It's not so much EPA, but more of the Corps. But discretion being the better part of valor, not wanting to take on another federal agency, and I'm sure the Speaker would like to address that somewhat, it was decided to adopt the language that was proposed by DEC and incorporate it into the bill.
EPA makes their decisions from 6,000 miles away based on conversations they have with groups that probably are not terribly familiar. So I'm going to endorse your recommendation that deal with local, state, rather than federal. All right.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Chenault.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Representative Chenault, represent District 34. This has been a hard choice for myself. We seen yesterday what another federal organization, NOAA, has done to Alaska. And while I personally would probably would rather have a fight with them over this issue, I think it's probably the better part of valor to deal with our own people in DECs versus the federal government. So. You know, reluctantly, we do support Amendment Number 2. I think it does weaken the stance that we would like to provide for in-state gas needs. But we think we may end up spending more time fighting a battle that we might not be able to win. And as you said, Mr. Chairman, those decisions are made by people 6,000 miles away. That I'm sure they can spell Alaska because it seems like everyone knows where we're at. I have concerns on what their thought pattern is. So I won't go any deeper than that. But as I stated, we'll reluctantly support Amendment Number 2. And we still hope that this continues to move our project along.
You know, I have some insights on the thought patterns of people on the East Coast who pretty much have looked at their state and said, briefly, what a mess. We just can't let it go on. So what we'll do is we'll protect Alaska from Alaskans so they don't do the same thing that we did. And that is as far as they'll go. That's their mea culpas to say, I just can't go and let those people up there destroy anything else. And they'll pay more for gasoline, they'll pay more for heating fuel, they'll pay more for their car, so long as they feel like this is the only way that they can feel better about themselves. And I've talked to people as far in Maine, and I said, how would you feel if we said the entire northern third of Maine ought to be returned back to its native condition, and we'll call it the Maine National Park. And he said to me, straight up front, I see your point, that when people in Maine make a decision on what happens in Alaska, and that's Maine, where they have some open land, he hadn't really considered it in that regard. So that's my guess is why I have so much distrust for people the other side of the Mississippi, essentially, who simply want to save Alaska for who knows what. So we have amendment number two in front of us.
Mr. Chairman, if I may really quickly, you may want to instruct the drafters to make line 12 correspond with the First Amendment that was drafted, so it's included in this actions described in C of this section. I guess what I would request, Mr. Chairman, is you give the drafter the authority to make the corresponding changes with the adoption of amendment number one.
Do we need to put that on the record, or is it on the record already?
Yeah.
It's on the record.
Yes.
Thank you.
As the official maker of the amendment, I heartily endorse that.
Lawyers.
You love us when you need us, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Grunberg, another lawyer. All right. We're lucky.
I'm looking at Don Bullock's legal memorandum of April 7th. Do you folks have that?
You probably do. I don't know where to look for it, but yes, I have his name written on one of the little tags. What's it look like?
It says judicial review of a right-of-way lease in HB 215.
To
address
the
Beth Curtula.
Beth Curtula. Mr. Chairman, looks like this.
Do we have that in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, we do.
Okay, good. Does the members of the committee? Okay.
Well, why don't you go ahead with it? And,
okay. It says on the top of page 2, however, and this refers to page 6, lines 14 and 15 in the bill. However, the language, quote, within the later of 60 days after the effect of this act or, in parentheses of, well, publication of notice, could be interpreted to extend the 60-day period that began before the effective date of the act until 60 days after the effective date, or to add a 60-day period to a period that expired before the effective date of the act. Mr. Bullock continues, I do not know from the language of the bill what the intent is. Perhaps the, quote, the later of, close quote, language may have been intended to be, quote, the earlier of, unquote. You may wish to clarify the intent of the timing provision with the sponsor. And it seems to me, if it is in fact ambiguous, you may want to clarify it in the text itself.
Do you feel it's ambiguous? Or you wouldn't have brought it up.
Let me put it this way. I'm not that familiar with this. But since Bullock brought it up, I thought it is worth bringing up. If there's an ambiguity, then I think we should clear it up. If there's not, then we should make it very clear what it is. And I'm just bringing that up to the sponsor and the folks who've really worked on this.
My reading of it, within the latter of 60 days after the effective date or publication of notice under 38, et cetera. And to me, but if it's not ambiguous to me, that's not a good idea to interpret the act the way I think it is. I think we need to look at that.
I just see if anybody else disagrees with you. I'm kind of looking at Representative Holmes and Mr. Wright.
And Mr. Chairman, what was the suggestion that we?
He just said if it's ambiguous, you may want to you may wish to clarify the intent of the timing provision.
And have trouble with the, you know, because it looks okay. It's the latter of 60 days after the effective date or the publication of notice under 38, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the reason why that language is in there because there is a right-of-way application that has been applied for already. By AGDC, And what we wanted to do is give anybody an opportunity, since we're changing the judicial review for the in-state gas line, not to shorten that period, but allow them, you know, the 60 days after the effective date of this to be able to put in a claim.
Let me do this.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So it's crystal clear. The intent is, in the language of Mr. Bullock, to extend the 60-day period that began before the effective date of the act until 60 days after the effective date, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
There's no question then on the record, and I just want
okay.
to be sure.
Ruth, is it Heath, Department of Law? Ruth, are you online? Oh, there you go. Oh, yeah, you wrote it out yourself. Well, then you've been listening. And John is also in the room. Why don't you come up at the same time? And, of course, we need you to put yourselves on the record. And then we're going to just ask you your thoughts on this one issue, which is page 6, was it 14, 15, 16.
Chair, Ruth Hamilton Hesse for the Alaska Department of Law and Department of Environmental Conservation.
John Hutchins for the Department of Law and the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office.
I'm sorry, I don't hear very well your last name.
Hutchins, John Hutchins for the Department of Law and the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office.
And your last name, ma'am?
Hesse. And Mr. Chair, Lynn Kent, with the Director of the Division of Water, Department of Environmental Conservation, is also on the line.
Oh, we're loaded. Okay. We actually have several other people online that said questions and have a whole list here, but we'll go with who's sitting in front of us right now.
Because we're still on the amendment.
We're still on the
We still have an amendment in front of us. Can we, do we want to dispose of the amendment without this conversation here?
Mr. Chairman, I'm comfortable, but I'm comfortable if everybody else is.
Okay. Representative Pruitt, was it your objection?
I removed my objection.
The objection is removed for amendment number 2, which, just for the record, was I.3. And is there any other objection? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 2, I.3, is adopted. Let's get back to the bill now. We're waiting.
Yes, I understand that. And I think since you've adopted Amendment 2, that satisfies my particular client in this case, which is DEC, relative to the primacy programs that's addressed in Amendment Number 2. So I would pass this on to Mr. Hutchins, who would be able to answer any questions you may have.
Your lucky day. Saturday, here you are in front of the Judiciary Committee, an opportunity to make a profound statement.
My client is generally supportive of the bill, and I'm only here to answer questions.
Okay. So we have two people supportive of the bill. Don't leave yet. We have
questions.
Pardon?
Questions?
Yeah.
Would this be a good time for that, Mr. Chairman? It'd
be an excellent time.
I thought.
Cannot imagine a better time than immediately.
Immediately, if not sooner. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify what we've got in front of us. We've gone through a couple different versions, and so I just want to make sure that in hopefully plain English, we all actually know what we're talking about. So my understanding of the bill is we've reinstated the old language that applied to all pipelines in terms of the ability to bring suit, and that's now basically unchanged language. Is that correct?
I have not seen the amendment yet, but yes, that's my understanding.
That's your understanding. And I'm seeing the sponsor in the back nodding.
You're about to.
Okay. I'm seeing. Okay. And so...
We take a pause for them to read the amendment.
Actually, read the amendment.
Right. So this amendment would preserve the existing language in 3835-200 relating to oil and all 3835 pipeline rights of way.
All pipeline rights of way. Okay. Thank you. And then it would add what is basically Section 6 language. Would apply just to natural gas pipeline?
That's right.
And Section 6 language would apply to more than just rights of way, if I understand. The intent of the bill is it would also apply to permits, leases, certificates, licenses, other authorizations for gas pipelines?
Yes, Section 6 expands 3835-200 to cover, as you say, permits and leases, with the exception of those things fenced out in Amendment 2.
Okay. And I'm just laying out, I'm just trying to make sure that it's clear what, that I'm actually clearly understanding what we're doing. And it would also limit the jurisdiction in those cases to Superior Court and disallow injunctions before a final decision. Is that also correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And it would apply to all in-state, I mean, I know we talk a lot about the so-called bullet line, and it would obviously apply to a so-called bullet line. It would also apply to such things as in-state spur lines. Would it also apply, to what extent are hookups considered pipelines?
It would apply to any pipeline that has a 3835 right-of-way. The 3835-20 sets out that criteria. It's all pipelines on state land with the exception of gathering lines.
Okay, gathering lines being more like the distribution lines within a city
right.
Okay. So getting it, for instance, spur lines would be, but individual hookups to houses would not? Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
Generally speaking. I'm just trying to figure out if they're running them, Mr. Chairman, and I'm just trying to, I'm not actually necessarily going.
She made a point I was thinking of, and that is if it's buried in the ground and is carrying a petroleum product, is it a pipeline?
If it doesn't have a lease under 3835, it's not covered by this amendment, even if it is a pipeline. So that would be limited to pipelines crossing state land above a certain size that are not gathering lines.
Okay. So it could be, for instance, Mr. Chairman, if you've got a spur line and it's running under a state highway, they'd need a lease to run under the state highway. That sort of thing would theoretically be covered by this. I'm just trying to figure out what we are and aren't talking about.
That's possible. I'd have to look at that.
Okay.
The fact that it's running under a highway, is that relevant? I guess there are highways, lots of places, and they usually drill under the highway and install the line without disturbing the highway even. So,
well, it's relevant only if there is a requirement to have a right-of-way lease under 3835. If there is a right-of-way lease under 3835, this statute would cover it.
That's interesting to me that the highway has a right-of-way. And the pipeline needs a right-of-way. Can those be shared as the right-of-way, or are those two right-of-ways?
The state can have two rights-of-way over state land, issue two rights-of-way to two separate entities over the same piece of state land, yes.
Different permits?
Permitting decisions would be separate, but there could be different permits, yes.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On a slightly different tack, going back to the challenge section, how would that work? It limits jurisdiction to the Superior Court, and it says that you can't have any injunction before a final decision. So I'm trying to think of how that's going to play out if somebody were to challenge it, and one of the people who could challenge it would be, for instance, I believe a competitor, a competing applicant. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so you've got, let's say, two competing pipeline companies, and one of them brings a challenge, and the judge cannot issue an injunction until there's a final decision made. I'm trying to think of how this plays out. If you get to the point where maybe the applicant or maybe the competitor was actually right, is that going to take so long that it kind of nullifies the challenge, or how quickly do we think we could get to a final decision?
If the Superior Court decided that the commissioner or whichever state officer was responsible for the permitting decision was incorrect, then presumably an injunction would be needed to unwind whatever had been done.
Ruth, you can jump in anytime you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Hutchins is perfectly
responded to the question regarding the applicability of an injunction.
It's good to hear that there's an agreement on that.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I have a clarification on my earlier question. My handy staff has found me the grant of right-of-way leases statutes, which says rights of way. I'm looking at 38-35-020. Grant of right-of-way lease says that rights of way on state land, including rights of way over, under, along, across, or upon the right-of-way of a public road or highway, or the right-of-way of a railroad or other public utility, or across, talking about river bodies, bodies of water, all sorts of things. So that's just fleshing that out since I'd asked the question.
Good. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few days ago, we dealt with a bill, and I believe it crossed the floor also, dealing with bonding and security. Rule 65, I don't remember the name of the bill, it's Representative Feige's bill. So this committee is quite familiar with issues concerning injunctions and at least security for injunctions. And it was HB 168, thank you. Here on page 6 at the end, notwithstanding the general jurisdictional statute 2210020, except in conjunction with a final judgment, the court may not grant injunctive relief, including a TRO preliminary injunction, etc. I have two questions for you folks. Number one, is that a violation of separation of powers? Number two, does it amend a court rule?
With respect to question one, I don't believe it is a violation of separation of powers. Anti-injunction statutes are not that unusual. With respect to question two, Alaska Rule 65 deals with injunctions, and it doesn't include a general grant of authority to courts to issue injunctions. It simply specifies the conditions under which the conditions that must be met before an injunction may issue. I don't believe this section does amend the court rules, although I have some remaining uncertainty on that.
You have some remaining?
Uncertainty on that.
May I follow up, please?
Please. Yes.
The thing that bothers me more than anything else, and as Mr. Wright pointed out, this was taken on a federal act that I was on the staff when it came out, Trans-Alaska Pipeline Bill. If the court can't issue an injunction until the close of the case, by then an injunction may be moot.
A court has equitable powers to unwind actions that have been taken. You can't issue an injunction that would restrain what has been done, but the court can craft relief that would satisfy.
You take it. I'm not talking about a legal question. I'm talking about a practical question. If the injunction were to be that they had to protect a stream or animals or whatever it was, you know, the question, the hypothetical I'm giving you without getting into the details, might be that a case like this could go on for a while and no injunction issuing, the state and the companies move ahead, and the alleged damage is done. And by the time the court would have the authority under this to issue the injunction, it would be too late. Now, does that raise any constitutional issues with you? Through the chair. It does.
He said it would be too late. I mean, it could be too late.
I'll be willing to concede it could be too. But under my hypothetical, you know, this is the fact. You're defending in court, and they're saying that I have a constitutional right to do this because if we wait till the close of the case, it'll be too late, and this is what will happen.
Through the chair, let me back up briefly. To a great extent, what is addressed in Bill 215 are decisions relating to the state's ability to grant to a third party and its own interest in acting. You can grant a right-of-way lease to a company to construct a pipeline. You can grant a permit to cross a stream. These are all actions that the state could take in on its own. The state is granting them to a third party, and the Constitution of Alaska requires a best interest finding before that is done. There are procedures, for example, 3835 generally sets out the procedures for granting a pipeline right-of-way. Those procedures require the commissioner to have a notice and comment period. They require the commissioner to evaluate whether the state's interests are met. They require the commissioner to examine certain factors that are set out in 3835-100 to determine whether the state's best interests are met.
Let me ask you, is this best interest finding apply specifically on the area you're talking about, or is that a general policy for the state on all projects?
If any state interest is being granted to a third party, the Alaska Constitution requires the state to make a best interest finding.
Thank you.
Could you continue, please?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead, John.
So the commissioner makes a decision that an action is in the state's best interest, and generally courts would defer to the executive, the commissioner, or the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation or Department of Natural Resources on those. And those findings would be challengeable as a rule on procedural grounds. Did the commissioner not follow proper procedures? Did the commissioner act in an arbitrary way? This act essentially codifies that.
You've danced around the question. If you need more time to answer it, that's okay. But I'm serious here, because that's getting to the heart of the issue.
Right. I'm trying to get there by a fairly circuitous route, I agree.
That's all right. We're with you as long as you can find an answer. Or if you don't, whatever, I just want to hear what you have to say.
So in general, I would expect if a court were reversing the decision of the commissioner, that decision would be based principally on procedural grounds. It would be a decision that the commissioner had not followed proper procedure. Notice, for example, was inadequate.
Mr. Chair, if I may, my question doesn't go to the merits of the court's decision. The question is one of timing.
Right.
The way this is written, it will not give the court jurisdiction to consider the issue until the final decision in the case. And the fact that it is divested of the ability to consider it early.
Right.
Is my concern. So timing.
You're agreeing with that statement?
I believe it is correct that it is possible to imagine circumstances under which the question becomes moot. Some irreparable harm has been created, but I believe it's unlikely because, for the most part, if a court were reversing a commissioner decision, it would not be because the court disagreed with the substance of the commissioner's decision. The court would be reversing the commissioner's decision because the commissioner failed to follow a proper process when arriving at that decision.
And there are remedies, even though one of them might not be to undo what was done based on the decision, but some other remedy can be used?
In general, what I would expect, for example, let's say a permit was given to us for a stream crossing and the court later decided that the permitting process didn't include sufficient notice, and so it reversed the stream crossing, the grant of the stream crossing permit. The pipeline has been constructed, it crosses the stream in question. Now, the hypothetical court reversal would have been as a result of improper notice. It would not necessarily imply that a permit for that stream crossing could not issue. So it may be that there is no real harm. Assuming there was a real harm, the court could order the pipeline relocated or moved.
Sure. I mean, if you diverted a stream, any judge could call that real harm.
Right.
And then you'd have to.
You can't re-divert the stream. How do you re-divert the stream? But
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see this bill pass. I'm concerned from a legislative drafting point of view. Because I just as to, and then you could say that, Representative Gruenberg, the answer to your question is would be in the application of the statute rather than in the statute on its face, that maybe as applied, you can't apply it in those circumstances. There would have to be some kind of a an ability for the court to do justice and this sort of thing. I don't know. I haven't thought of how this could be crafted so that it would allow the court to do what it needed to do without violating the intent of the bill. And I don't really have my question answered. I'm sorry I talked too long.
Through the chair, I believe if this committee and the legislature generally wants to ensure that courts do have the ability to issue an injunction where there is a possibility of irreparable harm, that has to be written in the statute. I don't believe it is at
that
this
has to be what?
Written into the statute. I don't believe it is at this time. I don't think a court could read this and find exceptions to the injunction language that would allow it because the court really thought maybe there was irreparable harm.
So, through the chair, so you believe that the way the statute is written, that no matter how great the harm, the court has no jurisdiction at all to issue any kind of an injunction until the close of the case? And that might be, presumably, after appeals are exhausted too, right?
I believe that is correct, although I would again qualify that by saying, in general, the harm we are talking about is procedural rather than substantive. It's going to be failure to give notice.
Whether it's, I don't care the basis, that's not my issue. My issue is how long it would be before the court would have any jurisdiction to have this injunction take effect.
As the bill is drafted, after a final judgment, the court could issue an injunction that would not be after the appeals process. That would be at the time the final judgment is issued in the initial case.
You want to pause for a minute here?
So, through the chair, so your interpretation on line 1, page 7 of the term final judgment would be final judgment in the sense of the entry by the clerk of the court rather than final in the sense that all appeals have been exhausted.
That's correct.
Ruth agrees?
I agree with
you. Thank you.
And my next question then.
Go ahead.
If that's the interpretation, or do you see any constitutional problems with that? Which is my original question.
I don't believe so, but I would have to get back to you.
I would appreciate that. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Wright, if this bill passed out of here today, would it be on the floor today?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Tom Wright, that's correct.
Representative Keller.
I would like to just go ahead and move, and if we get an opinion back that there is a problem, that we'll be dealt with on the floor. That's my suggestion.
Okay. I think this is the only opportunity we're going to have to delve into the legalities and the time periods and whatnot. And so far, I'm satisfied that with the response from the AG or assistant AGs, we haven't had any counter response that said, oh, no. And I'm okay with this so far, but if Representative Gruenberg has a question, he is a committee member, I think it's reasonable that we at least have the question presented to us and answered.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. This is a question that ultimately would be decided by a court if we don't deal with the issue. I mean, it might be decided by a court if it ever came up. I don't know whether it ever come up.
Well, Representative Gruenberg, do you have a remedy to the final judgment question?
No, I don't, and it's got a long way to go.
No, it goes to the floor.
Yeah, but then it goes over to the Senate, yes. Right?
And they're very kind. Senator Tom.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I've been, I won't say that. But you know what I mean. Seriously, I would like some really good legal thinking on this and to work with those of us who are interested on this committee and not, because I guess I'm going to say I'm troubled, but I'll give a no rec because of that. I'm not going to hold the bill up, though.
Okay.
Otherwise, it'll be a moot point.
Further questions from the committee? Go outside the committee. Merrick Pierce, Alaska Gasline Port Authority, did you want to make some comments?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and Mr. Pierce, I serve as the CFO and board member of the Alaska Gasline Port Authority, and I'll cannot think of a better way to spend the Saturday afternoon.
You're going to have to talk a little bit louder. We're missing every other word.
Very good, sir. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, we can.
Very good. I'll start over. I serve as a CFO and a board member of AGPUP, and I'll share my view on the bill. There are several pieces of legislation introduced late in the session that are apparently intended to foster a bolt line project by the AGDC. We've got House Bill 215 before you today, which limits judicial review on gas pipeline. House Bill 185, information related to the
Yeah, you're fading on us again, and we're not picking up your conversation.
Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll try to hold the phone just so. The great concern that I wish to express is in all of this, speaking very broadly, all of these efforts are intended to foster a pipeline project that is clearly not in the best interest of Alaska based on all of the empirical, publicly available information we have seen. We see a proposed bullet line route down the Parks Highway that bypasses Fairbanks, bypasses North Pole, and bypasses our key military bases. The project does not provide Alaska with affordable energy. We've seen the proposed tariff on this project of over $17 for a 10 or 50 MCF a day project. And the project does not bring Alaska the critically needed diversified revenue we need by LNG export, a component that we obtain with economy of scale projects and LPs. At last, this project avoids the already established existing pipeline corridor that holds tremendously valuable mineral resources. I hope you've all seen the work of Jim Dodson at FEDCO and Dr. Paul Metz at University, where they've clearly established that the Richardson Highway Corridor has both more people and vastly more mineral resources that will sustain long-term jobs with the availability of affordable energy in that corridor. And in all of this discussion about a pipeline route, gas pipeline route, we must not ignore our military bases, as AGDC has with their Parks Highway route, and here's why. Our military bases need affordable clean energy for the obvious reason.
Mr. Pierce, let me just ask you a question. Do you feel like this bill designates a specific route for a specific pipeline or is simply open to alternative routes?
I think, Mr. Chairman, what's happening here is you essentially can do a pipeline project two different ways. You can have a private gas line project, which will generally move forward based on its own economic merits. Then you can have a publicly funded project, such as the one that AGDC is promoting, that may not move forward with positive economics for entirely political reasons. So I'm skeptical of any effort to limit judicial review for a pipeline project that's not in Alaska's best interest.
Okay, and you believe this bill limits judicial review?
I believe that's a possibility, yes, sir.
Do you see that on some page and line in the bill, or is it a thought you have from reading the entire bill?
I haven't seen all of the amendments, but, Mr. Chairman, I have seen the limits on 60 days for review on the bill that was put forward on the 5th of April.
Got it. Are you... Do you need time to conclude your testimony, or is that it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'll just take another 60 seconds, if I may.
Sure. Go ahead.
Thank you, sir. Basic thesis that I want everybody to understand, and what's getting lost in this argument about gas pipeline routes, is our military bases, they need the affordable clean energy for the obvious reason. They need lower power heating costs and air. And the Air Force at Eielson Air Force Base can also benefit by having gas that they can use to make jet fuel using Fischer-Tropsch catalytic technology. And that's important because our military is under federal law that requires they try to derive their fuel sources from other than just crude oil. And we give Eielson natural gas, they can then make the pure jet fuel, makes that base more valuable. It's also a critical issue for Fort Greeley. Again, this is another military base that would be bypassed with the AGDC route. They're running their military power plant right now, Mr. Chairman, on fuel oil at over $4 per gallon. But the bigger picture here is that we've got a $14 trillion federal debt, and incredible people like former Budget Director David Stockman under Ronald Reagan is forecasting that significant cuts to the $800 billion we currently spend in defense spending are going to occur in the near future. And we can certainly expect another effort to close our military bases to save money. Eielson Air Force Base just missed being closed with the last BRAC effort. So to wrap up, the challenge for all of us is to do everything in our power to make it less likely one or more of our military bases gets targeted for closure by making sure the gas pipeline infrastructure takes care of their needs and reduces their costs as it does ours. So take-home message, all these different bills, it's 189, it's 215, it may be designed to prosper pipeline routing that's politically motivated, not on economics, but political motivation, that doesn't serve Alaska's best interests, should die in committee. I'm happy, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
And Ms. Pierce, I appreciate your comments, and they're on the record. I don't have anyone else that wanted to comment off-net. Is there anyone else off-net that wants to comment? Okay. Seeing and hearing none, Representative Pruitt?
I just wanted to fully understand the angle at which the last speaker was coming from. Can you explain to me your interest fully? I know you mentioned that you're with the Port Authority, but for the record, can you tell me your interest in this specifically? Because you're coming at it you're talking about routes and you're talking about how this benefits the military. I think it would be best for the record if you clarified exactly why you're coming at it with this angle.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Happy to respond to that. The voter-mandated route is one that follows all of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline corridor. And that route, you all understand, is the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline that goes from the North Slope to Valdez. That's an existing federally permitted corridor. And I think essentially the challenge that's going to be before the legislature as we think about the different gas pipeline projects is figure out the route that serves both Alaska's best interests and gets us the new diverse fed revenue. So the ultimate challenge, I think, is going to flip the bullet line that would go down the Parks Highway into the existing pipeline corridor and increase the diameter, and then you solve all of the problems. You get Alaska affordable energy, you get South Central affordable energy through Angus Spurline out of Glen Ellen, and of course you've got the valuable LNG component, which brings Alaska the diverse fed revenue that we absolutely have to have as we see it. Declining in throughput through TAPS. So that's my general interest, Representative Pruitt. Does that answer your question, sir?
Follow up, please. Yesterday we had a ruling on belugas and the impact where I live. And you're talking about a line that deals with federal permitting FERC regulations. Is it your interest that the state of Alaska should put all our eggs in one basket, and that basket running through a federal system at this point in time, when we see that right now there are restrictions being placed upon us? Or should we give opportunities to make sure that we come up with something that works?
Well, that's a very good question, very thoughtful. Certainly, if you just do an in-state pipeline, you're outside of FERC jurisdiction. That's an important distinction. But with regard to the Alaska pipeline, as conceived and permitted by the Yukon Pacific Corporation, there was very broad and supportive federal support for that project. The federal export license was issued for that project, so we crossed a pretty major hurdle. The Department of Energy said, yes, you are able to export gas for 25 years LNG. That permit is ready and available for the first date of shipment. The federal government issued the final environmental impact statement for that project in 1989, and all of the best interest findings and determinations went into that decision. So, clearly we have a project that has far exceeded all of the other projects in terms of federal support, federal permitting, and it would seem to me it would be most advantageous for Alaska, if, you know, if we're talking about spending $4, 5, 6 billion on a project, why not put that that equity into a project that has economy of scale and gets a community like Fairbanks $4 per million BTU gas, and gets gas to our military bases, and gets absolutely must have.
The last thing I would say is I just think I think it's in the best interest of Alaska to leave all our options open, and I think this is one of the options. I'll leave it at that.
I can just about assure you that the legislator is very much aware of the future of the state, and I believe this bill is in front of us as part of a solution to what the future holds. And routes and diameters are details that we are nowhere near at this point. How to monetize the gas for the benefit of the state and how to get some gas to the individuals in the state, especially in Fairbanks, where they seem to have maybe the most significant impact from the high fuel oil prices. So I'm going to shift now to Representative Thompson, who is actually from Fairbanks.
Yes, I just had a statement about Mr. Pierce's testimony. House Bill 215 would benefit any and all gas pipelines, no matter which direction they're going. This isn't designating a route. This is something that would benefit all of all gas pipelines.
Okay, we're close. Anyone else have some comments to make? Anyone in the audience have comments to make? Anyone online to make comments? Closing public testimony, bring it back to the committee. Any additional comments? I guess none. Representative. Representative Grunberg.
Before you make your motion, what I said a few minutes ago to Mr. Hutchins, I'm just going to work with them and the sponsor and other folks to see if there's a way, first of all, to see if my hypothetical is so far out that it really is nothing we need to worry about. And if it is something we need to worry about, to see as the bill moves ahead what we can do, if anything. That's why I'm going to be a no rep, but I do support the bill strongly. I just want to be sure that we're okay under the Constitution, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Any other comments? Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that Bill CSHB 215 version 27-LS0741/I from committee with amendments with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Any objections? Hearing and seeing none. 215 is heading for the floor. Let's take it at ease while we... House Judiciary is back on the record. The light is on. For the record, we have in the audience Sarah Felix and Gail Fanumiai. Sarah Felix is from the AG's office, and Gail is Division of Elections.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I hope you'll excuse me for a minute. I'm going to have to leave.
No problem. Yeah. So Senate Bill 31, sponsor is Senator Joe Thomas. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Joe Thomas, District D, which is basically Fairbanks North Star Borough and the Denali Borough. Thank you for having us here today. We're here with Senate Bill 31, an act relating to the counting of write-in votes. Senate Bill 31 looks to clarify our statute by utilizing language recommended in the Miller versus Treadwell decision of the Alaska Supreme Court and reinforced by the State Superior Court and the Federal District Court, and now also by the 2010 general elections review by the Lieutenant Governor. The language in Senate Bill 31 is from the Federal Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. It states explicitly that the Director of the Division of Elections will use the determination of a voter's intent as the guiding principle when counting and judging a write-in ballot's validity. Senate Bill 31 incorporates the concept Alaskan courts have applied consistently for over 50 years, favoring voter intent. The goal of Senate Bill 31 is twofold. First, to clarify our statute language to ensure that in future elections, as many Alaskans are enfranchised as possible. Second is to clarify existing language and strengthen the bill's perception of the Alaska's democratic process. Senate Bill 31's goal of ensuring voter enfranchisement and putting into statute inclusive rather than exclusive language will protect the fundamental democratic rights of Alaskans who enter the polling place with diverse backgrounds, abilities, and skills. Simply, we took language from the court case, Treadwell versus Miller versus Treadwell. I don't want to get confused, and put it. And attempting to put that language in statute. We know that the language that was challenged at that point in time was the language that suggested or indicated that you would have to vote in a write-in name would have to be put on the ballot exactly as it appeared on the declaration of candidacy of a candidate. The only declaration of candidacy that I've ever seen is my own. So therefore, the concept that if in fact there were, and that's the use of the language in the bill, is minor misspellings, things such as that nature that would without this language cause those bills to be invalidated, those votes to be invalidated. So what we're trying to do is fix that. We understand that that a lot of people enter the voting booth with a lot of different abilities and skills, so unless they are keeping track of exactly what's going on, and in the case of today's law, write-ins are something that there were challenges even to whether there could be a list of write-ins, but it is the intent, I believe, of the Division of Elections, and you can check with them to make sure that there should be a list of those names of candidates that are write-in candidates, which would substantially reduce the number of potential misspellings to begin with. And obviously there will always be some opportunity for such things to exist on ballots. With that thought in mind, when it is my understanding, you can also confirm this with the Division of Elections, when they do go through the write-ins, in fact, whether it is the discretion of the director or not, if there is concern, there are people there that can challenge those ballots. My understanding is that the ballot may be counted, but a copy of it is made and it is set aside in case we get to a point where those challenged ballots would have an impact on the election. If they don't, then that's not significant. If they were significant enough to have an impact on the election, then obviously that would end up in court. I don't think you can stop things from going to court, so I don't think there is any silver bullet. This certainly puts us forward in a fashion that the courts have used over 50 years, as I said, in the state of Alaska, and does clarify the law. So I appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill to you today, and I do have my staff, Greyer Hopkins, with me to elaborate a little more on some of the more specific areas of the bill. Okay.
Questions for the sponsor? Gail, can you come up? Representative Lynn?
Yes, thank you for bringing the bill before us. I know it was before our State Affairs Committee also, and this may not be the time to ask the question, but at least somebody can answer in the future. But, you know, we have a situation where there's a write-in vote for somebody, and it's either spelled correctly or it's not spelled correctly. And then you have the oval that's filled in or not filled in. If someone can determine that the intent is there to vote for candidate X because it's spelled phonetically correctly, or at least somebody can determine intent, and the oval's not filled in, wouldn't that name being spelled out there, wouldn't that show intent itself, whether or not that oval is filled in?
It would in my mind, and I'll let the Division of Elections may have a different opinion of that and what actually they would do in those cases. I think they do have an opinion on whether that would be substantial enough to cause them to accept that without having the oval filled in.
Well,
law, the bill.
Thank you very much. I wanted to put it on the table now so we could all be thinking about that situation when the proper person can answer it.
Do you want to walk us through the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Greyer Hopkins. I'm a legislative aide to Senator Joe Thomas. Thank you again for having us here today. I can skip forward quickly to and walk the committee through the bill and the changes that have been made in different committee substitute processes as we go through, and how the recommendations that were made by the Lieutenant Governor in his 2010 general elections review, how those are addressed within this bill. I'll start with Section 1 of the bill. Section 1 addresses the counting of write-in votes and the determining of the voter's intent by the director of the division. As you can see, if we can get the current version of the bill in front of me, as you can see, the subsection D, section numbers 1 through 5, address the counting of the write-in ballots and how that would be determined by the director. Currently in statute under 1515-360A, the numbers 9 through 12 of 1515-360A are what are going to be sections 1 through 4 of subsection D. So it's breaking out from the current statute that we have in place the subsections that deal with write-in ballots exclusively. So now we have two sections within statute if Senate Bill 31 is to pass, 1515-360A, which would deal with the counting and marking of standard ballots, and then moving on to 1515-360D, which would deal only with the counting and marking of write-in ballots. So it makes for a clearer statute, which was the intent of Senator Thomas and the division during the crafting of this CS. Section 2 of the bill puts into statute what is currently in regulations under 6AAC25.085 regarding the standards for counting write-in ballots and the dates and times for them to occur. Subsection A, numbers 1 and 2, deal with the trigger for counting write-in ballots. In most elections, there are a couple of write-in write-ins, whether it's for Mickey Mouse or for Grier Hopkins or for whoever. The election, Division of Elections does not count those write-in ballots until there is a legitimate opportunity for them to change the outcome of the election. When the machines are counting the write-in ballots, they only count the oval, the filled-in oval for those write-in ballots. Obviously, the machines cannot count the name written on the line there for the write-in candidate. So when going through that counting process by the machines, there must be either more write-in ballots total for whoever they're voted for, more ovals filled in for the write-in ballot than the number one vote getter of the normal votes, or within 0.5% of that number one vote getter.
So they count all the ovals for the write-in line.
Yes, sir.
As if they were all voted for one person, and then compare it to the next highest vote getter, and we don't count them then if we don't need to. But doesn't that tell the highest vote getter that there were many more votes that supported him, and he or she might like to know what that total is? There's just some way to produce that total for them as a courtesy, or do we simply ignore all the write-in ballots until such time as we have a challenge?
Mr. Chairman Gatto, as far as I am aware, they are ignored until that trigger kicks in for the necessary use of state time and state resources. The remainder of Section 2 deals with the time and place for establishing the counting of the write-in ballots. There wasn't a conceptual amendment in the last committee by Representative Seaton. It was created version X of the CS, and I'm not sure if the committee had planned on adopting that new CS or not. Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if your staff was planning on adopting version X. I can go over that amendment to.
Do we have this?
Yeah, this is.
We have a version X now.
CS for Senate Bill 31 X.
That's
what
we're going off of.
Yeah. That's what we're State Affairs version.
Sorry, I don't have it.
That's the issue. That's the one we have before us is X.
Yeah. Thank you. Now I have it.
So we probably jumped the gun here and probably should have adopted. CS version X-ray, and we can now, if I get a motion to do that.
I'll make a motion.
Representative Gruenberg?
I move that we adopt, for the purpose of discussion, the X version.
Okay, so we have in front of us House CS for Senate Bill 31 State Affairs, version X. In front of us, to work from, is there an objection to adopting the CS?
Only briefly. I'll object just really briefly. What I'd been looking at was the CS for Senate Bill number 31, Judiciary, the E-version. It appears from a quick look that the only difference is the addition of a subsection E on the bottom of page 2. Is that the only change?
Yes.
Representative Holmes through the chair. There's a deletion of two words in subsection C. Currently, the E version from Senate Judiciary said, if the director, I'm starting on line 22 of page 2, subsection C, if the director determines that the requirements of A of this section, the trigger for counting the write-in ballots, has been met, the director shall establish the place and date for counting those write-in ballots. It currently deletes the place and says shall establish the date for counting those write-in ballots, and then handles the place for writing those ballots or counting those write-in ballots under the new subsection E in version X. The intent of that amendment from Representative Seaton in the previous committee was to have a more secure ballot transfer process. Currently, after the counting of the different precincts around the state, all of the ballots are sealed, signed, and over that seal to ensure security, and shipped to the director's office here in Juneau. In order to eliminate the need to, again, transfer those ballots and risk more loss or damage to those ballots or tampering, Representative Seaton felt it was important to make sure that those ballots stayed here in Juneau for the counting process.
So who then? He deleted the word place?
And broke it out, Mr. Chairman, yes, sir, deleted the word place and created, and the legislative legal drafters broke out the handling of the place for counting the ballots in subsection E.
Okay, I see it. Because I was a little concerned. Somebody's got to determine the place. So he broke it out. They added new from State Affairs, subsection E. That probably accounted for why it's a CS.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grunberg.
Just a thought, and I'm going to ask Ms. Fanoumiai this question, too.
You want her up here?
Not yet. I just want these folks to. This is sort of a trial balloon.
This is a new conversation for Judiciary.
As I understand it, subsection, section 2, which is AS 15-365 could apply to any write-in election, like even a state house write-in election, correct?
Representative Grunberg through the chair, yes, sir, that is correct.
That being the case, and I was on state affairs, and this kind of went over my head at the time, and I'm glad we're hearing it again, because the question is, where should the write-in tabulation take place? And here it says, where the ballots are sent following the election. It seems to me that if the write-in were, say, in Representative Flynn's district or mine or Representative Keller,
I had a write-in.
Well, that they might be well advised to have that little election counted locally, even though it was initially sent down to Juneau or something. So I'm going to ask somebody if, even though all the ballots may go down to Juneau, but for the purpose of publicity, I mean, you know, transparency and confidence in the election, it may be better, and I'm going to say politically, to bring it back and count it locally. I don't want them to be constrained if that's the case. Through the chair, any comment?
Representative Grunberg through the chair, that was a concern that I had in the previous committee, and that does make sense. Possibly both candidates, it's a very close race, both candidates would like those ballots counted in their home race, in their home district, and so that their constituents can come see them. Currently, these write-in ballots are usually not not counted until all of the full 15 days following the election has passed, so that all of the overseas ballots have time to come in to the director's office. They're all mailed directly to the director's office. So it would have to wait those full 15 days for all of the ballots to come into Juneau and then ship them all back to Fairbanks.
And through the chair,
wherever.
Having been involved as a lawyer when Sharon Cisna was one vote behind Ann Spontholz many years ago, it's a hassle to get you don't have a lot of money to get your people transported all over the state. It's much more reasonable financially also to do it locally.
What happens to overseas ballots that arrive a day late? Are they sequestered or
Representative Mr. Chairman Gatto, all ballots that come in late after the current 15 days following the election are not counted for those for that original count. So the first certification of the count, the original one, those would not be counted. But if there were to be a recount, if the race were close enough to have a recount, then those late ballots would be included in the new count.
I was thinking of GIs driving a tank through the desert. There's really no opportunity to record your vote. They finally do, and it arrives late. We know that that should be as valid as any other vote, but it is set aside.
Representative Gatto, yes, sir. It would be. There's another bill moving through the legislative process that's currently in the House Finance Committee that handles a number of changes to the requirements for those military absentee ballots coming in.
Got it. Okay. Further questions? Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was a little confused. The language that's on page one of the bill, the language in D1, what exactly does that mean?
Representative Holmes, through the chair, that same question was asked in the last committee, so thank you.
it's the only section section D1, the very first section of the bill. Okay. It says writing in the name of a candidate whose name is printed on the ballot does not invalidate a write-in vote unless the director determines on the basis of other evidence that the ballot was so marked for the purpose of identifying the ballot. I'm just not entirely sure what that would be.
Representative Holmes? With the nature of the secret ballot system that we use, all of our ballots must stay anonymous for who voted them. If a person marked, you know, put a smiley face up in the corner or marked 12345 in the corner or wrote something funny so that they could go back and find, so that the director determined that they could go back and find their ballot at a later date to track it through the process or to find out where it was, that would invalidate that ballot if that person wanted to go back and be able to find it. So any markings to identify that ballot would throw it out of the process and invalidate it.
Okay, and so writing in the, if I may follow up, Mr. Chairman, writing in the name of a candidate, because when I first read it, what I thought it was saying is writing in the name of a candidate whose name is printed on the ballot. So I thought that was going to, for instance, the hypothetical, or not the hypothetical, the actual case in the recent election where somebody actually might have written in, you know, my name's on the ballot, Lindsay Holmes, and instead of filling in the oval next to my name, they write my name in on the line. And that's not what it means. What it's trying to go to is any identifying mark?
Representative Holmes, I believe there's 2 points to that section one. The second one being for the purpose of identifying the ballot. The second one being that vote for you, oval filled in, your name written on the line, would still count for you. Similar to what happened in the last election. Those votes that were filled out as a write-in and Joe Miller written in were still counted for Joe Miller.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Keller.
Mr. Hopkins, did you not say that was part of the existing law? The language is just being transferred here into this. Yes. You did make that point here, and I just want
to Representative Keller that. Yes.
Thank you.
So we have a line on the ballot that says write in, and you write in the name, but you don't fill in the oval. Why is it absolutely essential that we won't count a ballot unless the oval is printed when it's pretty clear what the voter intent was?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, that was not currently it is directly in statute that the oval must be filled in. Section D2 addresses that very precisely. Why the voter's intent would not be clear and how the director would deal with that, I'm not exactly sure, sir. We've been handling mostly with the determination of the name written on the ballot as opposed to the
Full count. You're going to spell a three-syllable name perfectly correctly, put a comma, get the first name, two-syllable name. That's no doubt what the voter's intent was, but that ballot would be discarded.
Mr. Chairman, the current process that we have, that would be correct.
Representative Lynn?
Thank you. Is not the purpose of filling in the oval so that a counting machine can count the ballot if the oval is filled in? Well, if you have a write-in, they're going to be looked at separately anyway. It doesn't go through the vote count machine. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lynn, through the chair, that would be correct. It would be thrown out as a blank ballot. An undervote would be the technical term for it. There's in 1515 360A, Section 1, there is a a list of different ways that the oval can be filled in. A voter may mark a ballot by filling in, A voter may mark a ballot only by filling in, making X marks, diagonal, horizontal, or vertical marks, solid marks, stars, circles, asterisks, checks, or plus signs that are clearly spaced in the oval opposite the name of the candidate, proposition, or question. So that would be the different ways that the person could fill in that oval. So it still leaves a good amount of leeway for what that person can do instead of filling it in perfectly for the machine to read.
Sure. Well, all of the ballots are going through an optical scanner, and as long as the oval's filled in, the scanner knows that those are write-in ballots and segregates them for a count, but you have to use somebody that reads them. Now, at this point, the scanner's not going to be able to read them.
Chairman Gatto, if the trigger to count the write-in votes by the state is enacted, then the director would go back and go through the process that we witnessed last November and count those write-in ballots.
And hanging chads have never been an issue.
Thank you, Evan.
We used to have chads.
Representative Thompson.
Yes, I can see a scenario where what you're talking about and why it shouldn't be counted. Let's say you have a ballot and the written actual names on the ballot, printed, are Pruitt and Holmes, and then you know that there's a write-in candidate, and you're looking at it, and you haven't made up your mind, so you write Gatto on the write-in line, and you look at all these three of them, and you decide, I don't like any of them, I'm not going to vote, so you don't vote anybody. Why would they then count Gatto? That's what you're bringing up.
Not for that.
But, I can see where there would be a reason why that oval wouldn't be filled in, and I can understand why it wouldn't be counted yet.
Representative Thompson, in the last recount, or in this counting process last November, every single one of those ballots that were marked, Lisa Murkowski's name written in on that write-in line but did not have the oval filled in, it was left blank, were challenged by the Murkowski campaign but then thrown out by the courts. No, sir. The Murkowski campaign challenged every one of those ballots that were thrown out for her.
She wanted them to be counted.
But they were not, and the courts upheld that decision of not counting those ballots.
I agree with that.
Representative Holmes.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess the problem, besides the voter intent issue, is the mechanics, and we can ask Ms. Fanumi a little bit more about that. But what this says is you're not even going to get to counting these ballots unless you're either the write-in line is the winner or so close to being the winner that they're within 0.5%. Well, the optical scanner is going to read somebody who writes in a name but doesn't fill in the oval. They're going to read that as no vote, and it's going to go off into a different pile. So, it seems like it would create some issues.
And that was a question I had.
Yeah.
Given the some elections were 0-0, mm-hmm. There was no winner, would we go then to the ballots that did not include the oval?
And, Mr. Chairman, I know it's really hard for all of us around this table to imagine that there are actually people who choose not to fill in an oval in any race, all of the super voters around this table. But some people go in and they say, I don't know anything about that issue. I'm going to leave that one blank. And the computer can't tell the difference between that and somebody who writes something in but doesn't fill in the oval.
Okay. Further? Yeah.
Super voters here.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just make one note. Senator Thomas said the Lieutenant Governor's review is currently recommending this identical language under on page 21 of that review. It specifically cites Senate Bill 31 as working to fix this issue and as a good idea. Senator Thomas worked very closely with the division and the director crafting the CS, which came out previous to the Lieutenant Governor's review, so they are very close to each other and what's recommended.
New stuff. All right.
This thing we're
busy getting.
Boy. I was going to say.
Okay, well, let's take a 3-hour break.
Mr. Chairman, that site was on page.
Oh, trust us. I think we read it cover to cover.
Page 21?
Yes, sir.
Page 21.
Thank you, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo.
Can I, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Pruitt.
Can I ask, if we're working on this right now to put it in, to codify it, does the current, this ruling by the judge already make it so that that is what has to be followed by the Division of Elections, and we're just basically backing them up by doing this?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, that's exactly what it is. In your bill packet, there's a page titled "Quotes of Significance from the U.S. from the Court Findings for Senate Bill 31," and it runs through a number of the quotes from the three different court findings: one from the Superior Court, one from the Superior Court, the Supreme Court, and the Federal District Court, all urging finding in support of voter intent and also urging clarification of the statute using this language in Senate Bill 31. So they even recommended changes to the statute. No, Representative Holmes, that's the alleged research report. It would be, I believe, one page before that in your bill packet.
I don't know that I have that.
It's interesting. It says, quotes of significance to Senate Bill 31 from the 2010 United States Senate race court findings. And I believe it will emphasize the voters' intent.
Thank you, my dear. I didn't have that. Now I do.
As a remedy for Alaska's flawed write-in statute. Oh.
That was a different judiciary chair, sir.
His name is
Okay. Representative Pruitt?
This may be for you guys, it may be for the division, but I've tried reading through it, and what determines, and I guess every name's different, how voter intent is going to be determined. It says by the director determining that, but there's 700 registered voters. We saw this with Murkowski. There were some very different spellings. I know some of the examples in here where they just put Murkowski, Lisa Murkowski, which makes her sound like she's a spy. That obviously we know what they were doing with that, even if it was extended. How is that determined? Is that something, we're trying to indicate that voter intent is what should be, and which I agree with, but how are we going to get away from this, the challenge of, well, they really didn't intend it, they didn't based on how they or whatnot?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, you raise an important point. That's the general meat of this bill, is how are we going to start deciphering what people mean, and as Representative Lynn pointed out in the previous committee, it's a very tricky process. We won't ever be able to know, because we can't go back and ask the people, because the ballot is anonymous, what they intended to do. Leaving it up to the discretion of the director, the one person, the director, the courts decided creates a single system for judging those ballots. The director will use the same standard, whatever it'll be, to be able to look at what the intent of the voter was in that race. Each race is going to be different. It would be too extremely difficult to be able to set up some parameters, some spelling saying you cannot be two letters off, it cannot be three letters off. It would create a lot of problems down the line to be able to try to specify what it can be. Currently, in the way the counting process is done is a very public process. At the table, there are two vote counters by the employed by the division to count the ballots for an entire precinct. They open up the envelope, they start dividing out the ballots, who they're for, and the director comes, and one of the boxes in this previous process was ballots that they were not sure. During this counting process, they are being watched by an observer from each vested party. So one from, in this specific case, one from Lisa Murkowski's race, one from Ms. Joe Miller's camp, and one from Scott McAdams' camp also, if they had decided to bring enough people. So as the director is making this decision on the intent of it, it's being watched by the public. Those public members who have been identified by the different interested parties can challenge the director's intent and what the director decided. So at that point, if they disagree with what the director said, she would put the decided ballot into the correct box according to her determination. She decides it's for Lisa Murkowski. She'll put it in Lisa's box. But based on that challenge, that a copy of that ballot would be made, put into a separate envelope, set off to the side, so that if it goes to court, following that, if there are enough challenges to change the outcome of the election, which there was not in this previous race, but if there were enough challenges to change the outcome of the election, the courts would then be able to go back and open each one of those challenged ballots and check the judges or the director's determination to make sure that they also agreed with it, creating another balance, another check and balance on that system for making the determination.
Can I follow up? And I apologize to the committee because I'm about to ask for details. I guess what I'm, because I think I get what you're saying, but I to help finish and clarify in my thoughts, and this is just my analytical mind, I guess I need to understand a little bit more of the process itself, not having been through it. Is there initially a challenge as they're looking through, because it doesn't come to the director until there's a challenge by someone surrounding it, and again, this may be for the department. I see her kind of moving like she's ready to go and answer. But
do you want to testify?
I can address this issue if you want.
I think that's a good idea.
It's whoever would be. Although I have to say, you might have a job at the Division of Elections if you ever decide to leave your good senator here.
Why don't you stay there, Senator? If you don't mind taking a seat, and we'll have the director up here.
That's right.
So you've gotten a free pass.
It's all pretty light there, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be right here back in a moment.
And obviously you understand. Please just help me, just walk me through the process, if you would, so I can, because I think I understand where he's going, but I just want to get how we get through and basically make sure that what we're doing here, are we actually helping, or are we just going through the motions of saying, okay, this is an intent, but nothing's going to change. They're still going to challenge everything. We're still going to go to a court case the same amount of – if this was in place last year, would it have changed anything? Would we have the same amount of ballots that would have gone to court and whatnot? So if you would –
Gail Fanumiai from the Division of Elections through the chair, Representative Pruitt. The way the process worked during the 2010 general election, as Greyer stated earlier, there were 15 tables of two election workers who were given a set of precinct ballots. Each table had an observer from each campaign present. The workers sorted the ballots into boxes, box one being votes for candidates whose names were printed on the ballot, box two being for votes that were blank, no ovals filled in, or they were overvotes. Box three were for those that none of the observers challenged, that they felt were perfectly spelled names for the writing candidate, Senator Lisa Murkowski. Box four were the ballots that were challenged by one or the other party. Box five were write-in votes for someone other than the main candidate involved in the write-in. And what happened was I would then, with the Department of Law and the observers present, look at those ballots in box two, which were the ones with no ovals filled in, and made determinations on whether they should be counted or not. Any of the determinations I made that were challenged by either party, then the ballot was put into a challenged not counted envelope or challenged counted envelope, which would be the case with the ballots that were in box four. Those were the ones that observers challenged for a variety of reasons, which were then sealed, not commingled with the remainder of the ballots that had no challenges whatsoever. So in the event that there was an election contest or an appeal to the court, that they would remain preserved for the courts to review. Does that help you understand the process a little more?
It seems like there's two layers here. So they would probably have three observers at each table, but then they probably had three observers at your table as well, questioning your decision of their initial question. So they basically could question twice.
Through the chairperson, I actually went to each table where the ballots were. The ballots never left the table, and each observer, each like I said earlier, each campaign had an observer present to make the initial challenge. They also had a lead person who came and made the final determination on any challenged ballots, on any of the ballots that were in box four or two that I made a determination to count or not count, and their lead person then made then a secondary challenge to, because an initial decision hadn't been made when they were initially sorted and challenged by the observers.
So my final question is, how does this help you? How does what we're doing here going to affect you when you're sitting there, and of course you got the media on you, and you got pictures, people with their iPhones questioning everything that you make? I saw the ADN articles.
we all did.
How does that help you?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the court cases that we had following this election were based on the specific spelling of that write-in candidate. Mr. Miller attested that ballot must have the name spelled absolutely correctly in order for it to be counted. Currently in statute, there's a word appears in the counting of the write-in votes. Here it is. Currently in, it would be, let's see, that's close enough. It would be 15.15.360, section D, number 4. Number 3 in your version of the bill. That word appears was what was in question in these court cases. Mr. Miller attested that it needed to, appears means it needed to be exactly as it appears on the candidate's declaration of intent. The courts decided that no, the word appears is intended to have a more lenient standard. If they said that if the legislature had intended it to be a specific correct spelling, the legislature would have used a more specific and precise word, such as exactly or precisely, in order for that, for Mr. Miller's claim to be true. They also recommended, as I said earlier, to correct the faulty write-in statute using this language that could clarify the use of that word appears, allowing for intent of the director. So, in that way, it would solve this problem of judging the specific write-in spelling. It would solve that problem. And no state in the union requires the precise spelling of a write-in candidate. You can't expect it as too much of a subjective nature for the write-in candidates themselves. As Senator Thomas said, we're never going to be able to solve all the reasons people will go to court over an election. It's too much money, too much power, too much influence at stake for people not to find reasons to go to court if it's that close. This does solve the problem that we faced last November, though.
Okay, so if someone, and I recall the Murkowski shirt that said Murr had a cow and then the skis, mm-hmm. and I heard talk to someone who said, well, I put C instead of K-O-W because there was a cow. So this would basically, there would be no, because of what we're doing here, and they put that C instead of the K, we would not, there would be no need for an additional challenge. It would make it easier, saying we understand what intent at this point is, it should streamline the process.
Representative Pruitt, it does not prevent somebody from challenging that ballot still.
They just look dumber.
yes.
So if you had M and then it just a sine wave and it ended in I, would that be sufficient? Or do we need it ending in KI? Or do we need MU? Ending in I?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, that specific standard is what would make it very difficult to be able to apply an intent or an intent standard across numerous races. Saying it must have three of the letters correct or four of the letters correct would raise a number of issues when dealing with the intent in future races.
Okay. Somebody wrote Miller in the write-in. But not in the and it filled in the oval. That would be set aside with all the write-ins, then, wouldn't it? Okay. Well, I'm out of questions. Anybody else out of questions? We're all out of questions. Representative Lynn.
Well, are we still going to consider this oval question, where somebody writes in the name and it's deemed to be correct? Are correct enough, at least phonetically, you think that's okay, but they did not fill in the oval. And writing in the name surely shows intent. It seemed to me with or without the oval. Could you go back into that area, please?
I'd just like to say then we would have to hand count every single ballot we have. because there would be some that would be missed by the scanners that would trigger what we're talking about here. So I think we're talking about a complete and utter change of how our elections are counted if we're going to start saying that just because someone wrote into and did not fill out an oval that we need to count that.
Wouldn't there be a box of no ovals?
Representative Grotto, yes, sir. Those would be the overvotes. Also, were they marked every single oval or two of the ovals, or undervotes where nothing is marked?
If I recall right, I mean, we just slip it into that box. Mm-hmm. It doesn't set it aside or anything in there. Okay. It's still going to be in a whole pile of other ones that we're going to have to, again, handle in a different manner as opposed to just sealing and saying this is what this precinct came out with in the end. Mm-hmm. So we could add to... Well, we might as well just throw some more money at her because we're going to have to add to the cost of doing our elections each year if we start saying that because someone writes in there, we're going to have to spend a little bit extra time and go through those. And please correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynn, if a voter takes the time to write in the name of a candidate, that's one step of the process, but as they continue to vote their ballot, filling in that oval is their final mark of certainty and validity, saying, yes, I am casting my vote for this candidate. And statute is very clear in the fact that, you know, unless the oval has some kind of a mark in it, a vote's not counted for any candidate, whether it be, I mean, there are races where people leave all the printed names even with no ovals filled in. And that was the division's interpretation of the statute with consultation of Department of Law, and the court did agree that no oval was not enough to determine that was true intent of the voter.
Ovals, it says completely fill in the oval. How about you just put a single line through it? Does it read that as filled in the oval?
Mr. Chairman, in 15.15.360A, number one, it goes down the list of possible marks that would be counted. A voter may mark a ballot only by filling in, making X marks, diagonal, horizontal, or vertical marks, solid marks, stars, circles, asterisks, checks, or plus signs that are clearly spaced in the oval opposite the name of the candidate, proposition, or question. That was...
We waste a lot of time completely filling in the oval, don't we?
Representative Gatto, yes, sir.
No, we're so careful.
And that's right before it goes in the shredder, right? Oh, I'm sorry, the ballot box.
Good luck on filling in mine, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. So, okay, we done?
Yeah, I appreciate your allowing us to discuss this, because I think when this goes to court, because the next person that, you know, is afraid they're going to lose out on their dream job, I'm glad we're going to have our legislative intent behind it. So,
got it.
Just one.
Representative Keller.
Last comment. When we get into the area where the director is looking at the intent of the voter, that is a very limited number of cases, we would hope. In other words, we don't want to get into the position where we have to consider the intent of everybody that votes. So, you know, to me, when you fill in the oval, that's a statement of intent that's very clear, and we want to stick with that. So.
Is there anything in the box that says if the oval's not filled in, it pushes the ballot back out to the voter?
At the polling location, Mr. Chairman, or once it's being counted after the polls close?
No, polling location. I put my ballot in, there's no oval, and it just comes right back at me with a...
Mr. Chairman, no, sir. You could decide that you don't want to... vote in your own race, and it would still count the ballot for every other. It would still go into the machine at the polling location, and then that night when it's being counted by the counting machine after the close of the polls, it would count every other ballot or every other race on that ballot that you filled in the oval for, marking that your race was left blank.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Further questions, Representative Thompson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill 31, version 27-LS0350/X be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there an objection? Unless Senator Thomas, you don't have an objection, do you?
No, I'm
you're okay. All right, then Senate Bill 31 moves from committee, and we are adjourned. Woo-hoo!